Good afternoon. This is Ask an Atheist. 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. It's, getting on towards the end of March now, so, the weather is getting palatable again, I guess, a little bit. I mean, it's still raining all the time, but at least there's occasional sun, which is good. What do you guys think?
I was pleasantly surprised this week. We actually saw that it was blue sky. It was shocking and amazing.
How are you doing today, Josh?
Doing great.
And Nathan, how are you?
Good. Confused with our blue stuff that's up. It's not gray anymore. I don't really know what to do right now.
I don't know. I like it. I need a certain amount of sunlight, which is absolutely why I moved to the Pacific Northwest. But But I don't need that much, and what we got today was pretty good. And I like the temperature here, you know, cold jacket weather, wet enough that I don't have to worry about somebody screaming at me about drought every 5 minutes. And so I actually kind of like the weather right now. This is maybe my favorite part of the year. Always a big fan of spring. But we should probably talk about what makes one of those things that, you know, in America, in the sort of the narrative of American politics, one of those things that is one of the quintessentially American things that drives politics forward and just lets us understand what we truly are about Americans. And that's buttholes.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about buttholes. All right.
I mean, it's kind of a crappy introduction.
But... Political demonstrator and artist Abel Azcona recently engaged in a performance project where the tattoo artist inked Make America Great Again around Azcona's anus. The event took place at a Chicago art gallery in the company of more than 500 onlookers. Azcona, who is an artist native to Basque Country, described the event as a queer political act that demystifies a taboo part of the body and weaponizes it to critique Trump's fascist motto. Azcona narrowly escaped a blasphemy charge in Spain in 2015 when he used communion wafers to spell out the word pederastia, the Spanish word for pederast.
Nice.
So we're talking downstairs about this, and it says, hey, it's happened in Chicago. And Becky's like, oh, yeah, the town also famous for Piss Christ. They're like, well, a few other things, too.
But now you have Piss Christ and,
yeah,
you know, anus tattoo, and, I mean, there's really no other place that Chicago can go from here. It's reached the pinnacle.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, you know, Blues Brothers. It's not hot dogs. It's not pizza. It's not architecture. It's not that weird harp looking Picasso sculpture. It's
rusty wagon wheels with slogans around them.
Yeah. Wow. That's a euphemism I've not heard before. I'll be honest with you. Yeah. It's this. It's bodily effluvia in terms of art. That's what Chicago is and shall ever be known for.
If only Santorum was still in the political sphere.
Ooh. I think I saw him on CNN the other day. It might have been in the medical segment. Hey-o! Yeah, I like the narrative about weaponizing a taboo part of the body, especially when said weapon can be used as a projectile weapon. I don't know about this one. For example, it doesn't have an O in it, so I don't know how that was. You know, there's a picture of it that I haven't looked at yet because I honestly haven't had time. Or
well, you should go look at it, and then people will know. Then at home, our listeners will be able to get an audio interpretation of.
All right, well, somebody give me some commentary. I feel like I'm hanging out here.
Well, I mean,
I feel like, you know, like I'm clinging on to this one, and nobody's backing me up.
This is a really interesting. It's really interesting because he's not just doing this as some tattoo. It's an art installation, and there was a crowd, and to some degree, obviously, it's making the news. It made it to our ears, so
this
totally worked, and. You know, now that this guy has a tattoo in some place where the sun doesn't shine very often, you know, now we can truly say this might be the pinnacle. This might be the moment where we can say America is now great again. So, you know, thanks, Trump.
That's a great use of that modern political font that I forget what it's called. Gotham. I think that's Gotham.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be.
So it's a tasteful tattoo.
Yeah, it's a tasteful
tasteless tattoo.
Yeah, tasteful tasteless tattoo. I think it's kind of appropriate that we're talking about body parts in the week that the Obamacare replacement just sort of fell apart under the weight of its own ridiculousness.
And also the room of 30 men making decisions over women's bodies.
Well,
yet again, you know, another one of, you know, yet another instance of that, you know,
which, but you're gonna have to narrow that one down.
I'll go more specific, but yeah, they tweeted, they actually willingly tweeted a picture of 24 white men,
okay,
literally white men, uh-huh, and their topic was women healthcare.
Where was this happening? Like, was this was it a conference? Was it a congressional hearing? What was it?
I don't have this.
Because it happens with such frequency that it's right, you know, it's not necessarily meaningful. I mean, the fact that it goes on is. But
I think it was a Mike Pence. Yeah, it was a Mike Pence post.
Oh.
Just a couple of days ago. And the caption is, appreciated joining at POTUS for meeting with the Freedom Caucus again today. This is it. Hashtag pass the bill.
Oh, this is the Freedom Caucus. That's all you got.
And it's Freedom Caucus, right?
Well, yeah, but the Freedom Caucus meeting to discuss women's health, that's right. That is the system working as advertised, because women, you know, according to the Freedom Caucus, women are not allowed to talk about they're not allowed to talk about medical health things at all, because God did not bestow upon them the, you know, the authority to think anything about their own bodies. Well, so for Freedom Caucus, this makes complete sense.
Well, and the Bible also backs, you know, women shouldn't be talking to men really, you know, about anything unless spoken to, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's take a few minutes to talk about the ending of the American Care Act or whatever they, you know, because they needed to make it sound more patriotic.
America's best health care plan of 2017?
Isn't America's best at, like, an eyeglasses shop? Isn't that what that is? I just want to say I called it. I knew this was going to fall apart.
Well,
I knew it. I mean, come on.
The thing, one of the reasons it fell apart, though, is because it wasn't conservative enough. Like, it did not do enough. Like, the Freedom Caucus hated this bill because it was not restrictive enough.
Well, let's speak tactically about the Republicans right now. They're very good at winning elections, but the thing that they're doing in order to win elections, which is a lot of really, like, a lot of weird grassroots stuff where they keep bringing out different parts of the electorate combined with some pretty awesome gerrymandering, let's not lie. But they're really good at turning out their electorate, motivating people, but the method by which they go about doing it makes it impossible for them to govern, because they stir up so many different caucuses and special interest groups and stuff like that, that it's very hard for them to maintain any sort of enough of a uniformity of opinion to get any real conservative legislation passed.
Well, it's really hard to be able to do that when your entire platform is about how bad government is.
Right.
I mean, you want to kill government. You want to make shrink government down to where
that's just noise. We all know they don't want to get rid of government, because they wouldn't be getting
they
all
wouldn't
this
have
money.
Their, absolutely. But that's how they sell themselves. I mean, they absolutely sell themselves. I mean, look at the deficit talk. Nobody talks about the deficit now.
Right.
Nobody. Like, it is not a topic that's brought up anymore, because who holds the purse strings?
No, I hear stuff from, like, the CBO and stuff like that about the deficit all the time, about all these things that administration is doing and how many percentage points the
I'm talking about, like, right-wing media. I'm talking about the media as far as, like, actually talking about the deficit.
They're the party in government. Of course they're not going to talk about how bad a job they do.
Right. Well, and on the whole thing with the Affordable
otherwise known
Care
as
Act,
the pig.
The pig, yeah.
It's the pig.
So on the ACA, that was brought in without Republican votes, but it was done on a compromise, and the compromise was the mandate.
Right.
And that was a Republican idea, and the whole thing is really Romney Care 2.0 anyway, which is a Republican something that they could pass in a
you're
Democratic
talking about
area, right?
Just for clarity's sake, you're talking about the original ACA.
The original ACA, right. And so, but the thing is that the Republicans have had this problem with the ACA, but their problem wasn't the actual ACA.
Right.
Their problem was the fact that, hey, there's this black guy in office and he's on the opposing party, and we need to stir up a bunch of fear and media talking points so we can go get elected. But that doesn't set you up strategically to actually make a win on any sort of vote.
Right.
And so they kind of shot themselves in the foot.
I think that's why we're here right
now.
I think that's a potential. I think that's kind of a they would have done it no matter what Democrat was in
well,
the White
sure,
House.
But I'm just saying it just adds to that. That's their whole.
Sure. They're going to use it.
Right.
Don't
yeah,
get me wrong.
Right.
But the thing is, they voted to repeal Obamacare 8,000 million times. I don't know. They had some sort of pledge that they would repeal Obamacare for once for every citizen of the United States. I'm pretty sure that was a thing. And they rode in on this wave of about how terrible Obamacare is and how they're going to get rid of it and whatever. But they've always talked about, and this is why I knew that this wasn't going to go anywhere. This is why I was fairly confident that the ACA would last at least the first congressional, term inside the Trump administration, is because they've spent so much time talking about how terrible the ACA is and how much we need to get rid of it. They've never had a really meaningful conversation about what they would replace it with, because they say repeal and repair.
They've had lots of opportunities to do
They had an entire election cycle.
But they assumed that they were going to lose.
Right.
Everybody assumed they were going to lose, so they didn't. They wanted to sell themselves as the party out of power. That's how they appealed to their
Trump
base.
Knew he was gonna lose. He didn't, but that was what smart money was saying, just proving that smart money usually isn't that smart. The other side of it, though, is that a lot of House seats were pretty safe in the House because it's the House,
right? But the House and the Senate were pretty much gonna be written off, yes, but nobody was actually thinking that they're gonna need all three branches of government.
No, they thought they might lose the Senate.
Yeah,
they were.
There was ideas that they might lose the Senate.
Smart money was that they were going to lose the White House. They might lose the Senate, but they were probably going to hang on to the House.
Right.
That was the way that was.
And the whole talking point scenario is if the Republicans don't have either the Senate or the White House or any one of the pieces that are missing there, that's their opportunity to whine and complain.
Right.
And that was Trump even. Probably to some degree didn't really want to be elected because now he can't complain about the president of the United States.
Well, he still complains about Obama. He will complain about Obama the very day he leaves office 6 months from now.
It's worked for him. Why not?
It is a system that works. Everybody says, well, he won, you need to get over it, liberals. But the fact of the matter is, I still hear about how terrible Obama and how terrible Hillary Clinton is from the conservative media every single day. They're still talking about it because it's still political hate for them, and it still works out for them.
Well, mostly because they don't have to talk about Trump at that point.
To continue my point, they've repealed Obamacare, but if you hit all the websites of the congressional folks who were running for office in 2016, you hit Trump's website to see what his healthcare plan is, there wasn't one. They never really had a clear idea of what they were going to replace it with, but they knew they had to replace it with something. Because we're continually seeing in the media from oddly conservative or at least conservative leading locations about people who are saying, well, I can't stand Obamacare, but the ACA saved my life. I mean,
continuing
narrative.
Not awareness that Obamacare and ACA are the same damn thing.
That's a strategic issue with their messaging. I mean, if you're going and attacking some ideal and then there's a disconnect between that ideal that you're bashing and what's actually going on,
right.
You're not actually going to get that thing repealed. I mean, you'll still get the talking points. You'll still get the people. You'll still get the messaging.
Yeah.
But you got to, if you're trying to do something with it, you're going to be at a loss there. So
pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to is, the strategy was to get into office on repealing Obamacare, but now they won gangbusters. They won bigger than any money expected them to win. And now they had to actually think of something, and they absolutely couldn't. And it failed in the House. Everybody was focusing on this House fight. It was never going to pass in the Senate.
Yep.
The Senate is significantly more centrist than the House, from both perspectives of American politics. And so it was. There was never a chance that it was going to get through the Senate, even with the filibuster-proof, finagling that they were doing. It just wasn't going to fly. So this is why I thought, I thought it was going to die in the Senate. I thought they would pass something absolutely ridiculous in the House so that Roy Blunt can go back to Missouri and just say how great he is and how wonderful it is. that he did this, but it was all the other politicians that totally pulled the teeth on this thing. But he can't even go back and say that.
Yeah, and honestly, this really looks good for us, because this not only makes Trump look bad,
yeah,
this makes all the Republicans look bad, and this even makes Paul Ryan look bad, which is a big deal, because Paul Ryan was once he calls himself a political wonk. People think that he's some kind of numbers genius.
Yeah.
And the guy is a moron when it comes to anything out of his Ayn Rand fantasies.
Is he specifically an objectivist? I've never heard him talk about it.
He was always talking about how he always liked reading Ayn Rand while working out at the gym.
Okay. But, I mean, Mitt Romney said Battlefield Earth was his favorite novel. Did anybody actually believe that?
I might believe that, actually.
Okay.
I could actually believe that.
I don't know. But I think it's, you know, I think this part wasn't scary to me. I mean, it was an interesting drama. It was it was a fun movie. CNN was mildly less annoying for about 24 hours.
Yeah, it was obvious how it was going to go.
Yeah, but I knew how this was going to go down. The part that scares me is next term. Is next year or 6 months from now?
Well, a lot of the momentum that we have now, to be honest, I don't know if we're going to be able to keep the momentum necessary through the 2018 cycle to be able to change some of the faces in the House and the Senate.
But they've got another chance before 2018 even happens. And this is before 2018 mobilization gets underway a year from now. What we have is we have one more session of Congress, and now they've bought themselves some breathing room. They set basically the same people next year. They've got time to think about it, and they get time to not only come up with something that's probably worse than the AHCA, that will either appeal to more caucuses within the GOP, or they'll call in enough favors. Trump will promise to fire people that he can't fire, and then they'll come up with something that'll actually work. It is next year's model that scares me way more than this year's model.
I would say that the Republicans are too fractured on this particular issue. It's one of the reasons why they've not been able to get a consensus or get a replacement in the last little bit.
Yeah, no, I absolutely concur. They're shown that they're not able to do anything. They're not able to work together. Basically because they all have their different moneyed interests. So, I mean, if they don't get... I mean, other than the fact that, like, this was a big, big tax cut for all the rich people...
Yeah.
Literally, it doesn't help anybody. Like, it destroys their constituency, which means that they don't have a means to actually sell this to the people.
Yeah. But I think so. I mean, from somebody, like, from my perspective, who does see... universal healthcare and, you know, healthcare of citizenry as a part of my personal belief system, as both a socialist and a secular humanist, I'd want to spend the next year showing people that the ACA, while it doesn't work great, it works as advertised. I mean, they're going to be very, you know, the House and the legislators are going to be very inward focused, because it wasn't the people that killed this. They killed this themselves. So they're going to be very inward focused. So this gives people who support the ACA or supports concepts like this an opportunity that we can take advantage of. And I think this happens before we even mobilize for the 2018 election cycle, which is also something I think is very important. So I think personally, we should take, I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about it with people. And I think other people may want to consider the same, is that there is a threat here. The threat continues. But there's also, as always, when there's some sort of weird political threat, there's usually an opportunity as well.
Yeah. And I think some of the talking points on the ACA is if we talk about, you know, liberals or progressives or the Democrats or whoever, we also don't have a good consensus on, you know, who likes the ACA and not, and certain people like certain parts and not. And really everybody knows that, you know, of course, universal is basically the way to go. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you're looking at it fiscally or just as a whole solution, right? But if we can focus on, okay, the problem with, you know, a lot of people want to talk about how anti-Obama they were. Well, it's not like as somebody who voted for Obama twice that I'm totally in love with everything that he did. You know, there's a lot of a lot of portions that are very Bush 2.0 that I was not very pleased with.
I could probably do a whole show just on how he treated the Patriot Act in Guantanamo Bay alone.
I got a
lot of things I can say that I do not like about
Right.
Obama.
And so yeah. I think focusing on that, it's getting into the spot of sort of this middle ground of, well, the ACA works in this way and it works really well and people across the board like these provisions in there.
Right.
That makes sure to keep the provisions that people want, and we can really focus on, you know, not worrying about, oh, this is Obama, this is the, you know, Trump care, this is Obamacare. You know, it's really changing the messaging to the issue rather than the politics. And that's probably the largest, the greatest way that we can change how people talk about it on both sides of the aisle is to focus on the issues.
The Obamacare got its name Obamacare because the Republicans thought this was going to be a huge failure and would be easier for them to defeat if they attached Obama's name to it. It's not like the Democrats were calling this Obamacare.
No, it was literally so they can slander Obama when it failed.
Right.
And ipso facto, the Democrats.
We just gotta, as far as that goes, people who are in favor of this, you know, based on evidence, need to keep doing what they're doing. They can call it Obamacare, but that when they start saying, oh, Obamacare, da 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 da, then we can bring up the existing narrative of people who hate Obamacare but support the ACA. You'll notice even within the context of this conversation right here, I have no problem calling it Obamacare, whatever. It's the popular name.
Obama's fine with it.
But when
that was the point where
I don't care about that. Obama can be fine with it. Obama can hate it. I don't care. It got called Obamacare. That's what we're calling it.
Right.
When we start talking about the nitty gritty of what it does, call it what it is. It's the ACA.
Right.
And we can talk about all the weird socialized health programs that it has, but the other side of it that we're not talking about is all the patient protections, which is part of the reason why the Republicans are trying to say repeal and replace and not merely repeal, because the ACA fixed a lot of things that even there they thought were problems. Although my favorite line is, I can't remember which legislator, which representative it was, but it was somebody from a southeastern state that says, the ACA is $8,000 or 8,000 pages of text. I don't know how you get 8,000 pages of freedom. That was actually a quote. That was actually said. I'll need to find out who that was, but man.
That's along the lines of, the English was, English is good enough for the Bible, it's good enough for me.
Well, I mean, if you're going to talk about 8,000 pages of freedom, I mean, you know, if you start reading Ayn Rand, you'll get pretty close, right?
I don't know that I'd call that freedom. Well, this is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. I usually try to keep this week in the best words to one segment alone, but there's another story we gotta cover. So when we get back, a little bit more politics.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Has Ngadwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngadwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an Ngadwe Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTFPod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait a minute, not sacrificing children, that's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTFPod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's more than basic.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic, 844-753-7842. So we have another story. Yeah, it's this week. We call the segment This Week in the Best Words, but we haven't really spoken about the best words. We've been talking about just standard legislative LNP words. So it was recently revealed that Donald Trump presented to German Prime Minister Angela Merkel an invoice for NATO services. The bill is allegedly backdated to 2002, when Merkel's predecessor Gerhard Schroeder pledged to contribute 2% of the nation's GDP towards general defense spending. The invoice is alleged to be around 300 billion euros, a figure calculated by determining the amount by which Germany fell short of its stated 2% commitment plus interest. The invoice is reportedly being ignored by Merkel.
Are you telling me that's not how that works?
No, that's not, as far as I know. I mean, I know I'm not really a military guy, and I am very specifically not a NATO guy. Not for any, you know, just because I'm not. And I have no idea. I'm not used to presidents handing over bills like that. I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is either.
The irony is palpable here. I mean, we have Donald Trump presenting a bill to Germany for not meeting their obligations when he's built his entire empire upon not paying people that have done work for him.
Yeah, and isn't he like president of the I Hate NATO fan club right now? Or anti-fan club, as it were?
I mean, at most, this is a publicity stunt.
Right.
This is literally just seems to be something just like sit there and say that nobody takes NATO seriously.
Well, I think
except for America.
I think it's specifically a publicity stunt. And I think it's and this is why I spent so much time talking about the healthcare thing last segment is this was something that happened while Angela Merkel was in the United States, which was a few weeks ago. And we're hearing about it today on Sunday. The articles that I'm referencing were written today, a few hours ago. After the failure of the AHCA, I'm thinking this is, I did this cool thing a few weeks ago in order to establish himself as a manly man now that Trump's plan to make healthcare great again just fell through the floor and he had to go on TV and say to the American people, I don't think anybody realized how hard healthcare is. Which might be the greatest thing he's said.
Well, what about that 8,000-page guy?
But he wasn't talking about healthcare. He was talking about freedom. It's an anti-intellectual presidency. It's not the first one we've had, but it's the first one we've had, I think, in a long while.
Yeah, like 8 years, you mean?
No, you see, this is the thing about George W. Bush is that he himself may not be that bright a guy compared to other presidents, but he surrounded himself with basically what was left over from the Nixon administration, which
true.
Say what you will, we're an intellectual bunch of guys. I mean, maybe evil, but intellectual.
Effective.
Effective, yeah. I mean, you got Rumsfeld, you got, you know, people Cheney. Like Ashcroft, Cheney.
Yeah, Rumsfeld, was he totally called where Obama, Osama bin Laden was.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's either somewhere in Afghanistan or somewhere outside of Afghanistan. See, he knew. He's a smart guy. He got it.
Yeah. I know where bin Laden is. Somewhere on Earth.
There are known knowns and known unknowns, but you don't know the known known.
Well, I mean, but that's part of it. Like, his intellectual BSing was at free jazz levels. I mean, it takes some talent.
His free jazz was at free jazz levels too.
Yeah.
He was certainly at William Lane Craig levels of BS.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not saying that he was right, but I am saying is that there were some gears turning up in that head of his. And that's not what really is happening here. It's March nearing April, and the vast majority of appointments that Trump has to make to the executive branch of the United States have not been made yet, and he hasn't even really suggested people.
Hey, he's just cost effective.
Yeah, cost effective.
Yeah, think of all those positions that aren't being paid.
Yeah, and what we're hearing about is him going golfing, which I don't care about. Being president, it's
not a big deal, except for he made a big deal out of it.
Precisely.
He made a big deal out of it.
That was his thing, and this is something that I'd always said before, was I don't care how much golfing presidents do. I mean, I judge you if you golf. Don't get me wrong. But if it's your sport and it's what you do, and you're the president, you got, you know, your own special secure golfing area, and you're surrounded by people if anything happens, it's not like you're out there alone with the drink cart. I mean, you've got
people. Yeah, if
something
happens, you can get back into the office probably faster than I could.
Yeah,
drive across town.
Yeah, so. You get your butt dragged in, complete with tattooed butthole, dragged back into the right back into the situation room. So it's always been a non-issue, just political haymaking for me.
Right,
but then this guy built his entire freaking as you pointed out, his entire freaking political career on how much Obama goes golfing.
And how much money Obama spent on travel
and vacations. And
vacationing, and considering that we're only 2 months in and he's already beat 1 year of Obama spending.
Yeah.
I mean, and being the president is a very stressful job, and it's also really expensive to be the president.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's almost like he should have seen it coming, but it turns out that being an anti-intellectual isn't really that sustainable for some reason.
I don't know that he's supposed to. I don't think he cares. He just saw a potential weak point in I mean, what does campaigning have to do with truth values?
It's just marketing.
It's marketing.
Yeah.
And so.
He's brilliant at it. I wouldn't call him genius, but
I wouldn't call him brilliant at it, but he's very good at reaching specific segments of the population with his steaks and his vodka and his really expensive, and
water.
his steak vodka and his vodka steak.
I love the fact that he sold vodka with his name and he doesn't drink.
Yeah, he doesn't drink.
He was able to sample it or anything like that, but hey, put my name on it.
And that, yeah,
and
isn't
it failed.
I'm still waiting for some company to start like totally ripping off Trump brand label and putting it on water bottles and just shipping it all to Flint.
Yeah.
Just as a political statement.
And you're allowed to name things after the President of the United States.
Right.
There is a long court history of being able to name things after presidents because presidents are symbols of the United States.
Yeah, he's now public domain to be able to make
like
fun
this
of.
This is now public domain?
So I could
this
do,
is awesome.
I could do Trump beer.
Sure.
I mean, I don't want to, but I could.
I suppose. Yeah.
This is the greatest thing ever now. I mean, if we can actually use Trump as a public domain, I mean, if we could use his face, why not? Let's do it.
Yeah.
Trump's going to be the weirdest ex-president ever.
Yeah.
That's a very high bar.
Yeah. Is he going to be, like, people like to compare him to other presidents. I think he's going to be like the anti-Jimmy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that
might be. Tearing down houses for poor
tearing
people.
Tearing down houses.
He's already been doing that pretty much, so.
All right. Well, let's I don't know, something kind of nice about the United States. A U.S. immigration judge has approved asylum to a teen blogger from Singapore who had twice been jailed for expressing critical religious and political views. Amos Yee attracted the attention of authorities when he posted a YouTube rant criticizing and ridiculing Singapore's late founder, Lee Kuan Yew. Yee served a sentence in 2015 for willfully harming others by using offensive and insulting words and profane gestures to hurt the feelings of Christians and Muslims, as he had compared the leader to dictators and Jesus Christ. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security initially opposed Amos Yee's application and has until next month to appeal the judge's ruling. Not all is rotten in the state of the United States.
Hey, you got to do something every once in a while.
Yeah, this is just one of I don't know that I've been talking about it very much on Ask an Atheist, but I've been following the Amos Yee story for years now. And, you know, he was somebody who was critical of Singapore and the way Singapore does things. And he's a teenage blogger, so he says things like a teenage blogger says things.
Yep.
And was declared an enemy of the state by Singapore,
which isn't really that high of a bar. Singapore is a little bit it is a little bit silly about certain things, like their littering laws are some of the most draconic out there.
You know, I used to say, oh, they're just a tiny bit fascist, but I look where I am today, and maybe I'm not gonna say that quite so loudly.
Right.
So knowing that he's getting asylum within the United States, I think is, you know, maybe not the greatest ending, but the Grinch's heart is not going to grow five sizes too large. So, you know, maybe asylum in the United States is the best we can do.
Yeah, and I would say to Lee that also the Pacific Northwest is actually a beautiful place to live, so we welcome you.
Hey, yeah, happily. If he makes it out here, I'd love to have him on, no question about that. But that, yeah, that would be quite cool. All right. So from one cool story to another cool, it's a story that has very little to do with the United States, but remember Pokemon Go?
Oh, yeah.
Is Pokemon Go still a thing? Do people still?
Ingress is still a thing, so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who plays Ingress? I haven't seen anybody playing Ingress in years.
No, Pokemon stole and took that thunder.
Okay.
Well, it's the same platform.
So. Yeah, I know it's the same platform, right. But.
I want to make a correction real fast.
Uh-oh.
I accidentally said the wrong name.
Oh.
So, Singapore's late founder was Lee Kuan Yew. We don't want him here.
No. Okay, sorry.
Amos Yee is
the blogger.
Yee,
yeah.
We welcome you to the Pacific Northwest, and I apologize.
Instant correction, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, no, it's Amos Yee I'm talking about. It'd be good to have him on the show. That's what I'm
Absolutely.
Saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So Pokemon Go. You know, let's get to the really important things. Not about persecuted bloggers, whatever. Let's talk about Pokemon. When Pokemon Go came out, I was really excited because I remember Pokemon at the turn of the century when everybody was like, when Christians were all up in arms because Pokemon are demons and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we started this thing called Pokemadness, but it kind of died, you know, where I would talk about a Pokemon story every week and it kind of died off. But today, I've got a Pokemadness story and I haven't even read it yet. A trial has begun for Russian blogger and YouTuber Ruslan Skolovsky in the city of Yekaterinburg. Sokolovsky faces charges of inciting religious hatred and insulting the feelings of religious believers after uploading a video of himself playing Pokemon Go in a Russian Orthodox church. The 20-year-old was initially put on house arrest, but has been in a pretrial detention since October. He faces up to 7.5 years if convicted. Okay, so this isn't nearly as fun as I thought it was going to be.
Well, I mean, at least it was, like, you know, the Orthodox Church, while they're very conservative, I'm sure is a higher percentage of the Russian Orthodox clergy that play Pokemon than maybe some of the other religious groups out there. So, you know, there's maybe some wiggle room here for him.
One of my favorite stories about Pokemon Go, at least in the United States, was how offended churches were getting, because Pokestops and, like, Pokegyms always seem to be in churches.
Because that's where people congregate.
Yeah, and they got that data, and they decided to place things in those businesses because they used data from Ingress to figure out where people were playing.
It was really great when people started to play Pokemon Go on the Microsoft campus. I could see where all the Ingress portals were. You just look, and oh, there's that was that spot I was looking for.
Yeah, is that these things were being established where people were playing the game. And so right. Why was there a Pokegym there? Why was there a...
Because there are people there.
Vendemon there? I don't know what they're called. Is because people were playing there. And they're getting mad at Nintendo and everybody else when they really should be, you know... Maybe you need to work on your sermons. Maybe that's the problem there.
It's the fact that, like, he faces up to 7.5 years if convicted for playing Pokemon in a church service.
Yeah.
This is the same country that just basically said that it's okay to beat your wife as long as you don't leave a mark.
Right.
It's just astounding.
It's almost like these religious values are not a good idea.
Like I said, I love these Pokemon stories, but then I find out somebody's spending 7 years in prison because of Pokemon Go.
Hey, at least you got to play some Pokemon.
Yeah. Yeah. Are they going to let him play Pokemon Go in prison? I think that might be the question. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-Skeptic, 844-753-7842. And go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to a politician, aren't we? That's kind of fun.
That's the idea.
Yeah. We'll be talking to Noah Dyer, running for governor of Arizona.
Correct.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
48 hours. 24 hours. 10 minutes to go.
Now it's hard to see. My God, the rain is coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee. ANNEXRadio.com. Now on iTunes and Stitcher.
Billy! Billy! I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-Skeptic, 844-753-7842. We've got some business to take care of. I'd like to thank Jared and Clint from the internet, Paul from Ashford, Washington, and Angela from Australia for meeting Peggy's challenge. Peggy's challenge is the challenge to listeners of Ask an Atheist by Peggy from Kent to help us keep the lights on. You can go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, take you directly to our PayPal page. Every dollar you give us goes directly towards show production. Joining us now is Noah Dyer. He's a business entrepreneur, former school teacher, author, and video game programming instructor in the greater Phoenix area. He recently announced his candidacy as an independent for Arizona governor. How are you doing today, Noah?
I'm doing wonderfully, and I should clarify that I'm running as a Democrat.
You are running as a Democrat. Okay, fantastic.
I am, yeah.
I used to work near their offices in downtown Phoenix. There's a really nice...
Oh, very good. Yeah, they're right in the heart of downtown there.
So. Yeah. Really nice sushi place used to be right there. Actually, it may still be there for as much as I know. So to start off...
I'm not sure I've had that. Check it out.
So to start out, given the nature of the show, this is a show about atheism, humanism, skepticism, agnosticism.
Sure.
How would you describe yourself in that territory?
Yeah, I describe myself as an agnostic. Certainly, I was raised in a... conservative household. Specifically, I was raised Mormon and served a Mormon mission, and many of my family members still are Mormon, and my kid's mom is still Mormon, and my kids are exposed to that through her. So lots of religious background, but I myself am an agnostic.
Awesome. That certainly fits in with the show. What motivated you to run for governor?
You know, I was Arizonans, I think nationally, but Arizonans in particular, are hungry for government that is transparent. They're tired of feeling like their politicians are not giving them the whole story and making decisions while only giving them part of the story. And so transparency and honesty is a huge part of my platform. And then beyond that, Arizonans are very concerned about education. They're concerned about equality. You know, on late night television in Arizona is something of a joke as being kind of a anti-immigrant, anti-diversity place. And that's not the reality on the ground here, but our leaders historically have portrayed us that way. And so I'm excited about changing that national perception to be in line with the reality of how Arizona is.
Have you held public office before, or is this this your first go at it?
No, this is my first go. I've had politics in the back of my mind for a long time, and I suppose done some political philosophizing and things like that, but actually taking the plunge and running for office, this is my first shot at that.
Fantastic. So what's interesting, and I think what got our attention out here, is I'd heard about you because, like I said, I pay attention to politics in Arizona, you know, lived there quite a long time, but you're getting a lot of attention nationally because of your candidacy. What makes your candidacy unique?
Well, speaking earlier, I mentioned that, you know, the honesty and transparency. And so whereas standard political strategy is to, hide everything that you've done that may make anybody even remotely question your integrity or your intelligence, and to try and present a very clean and flawless front. And I kind of turned that on its head by having a page on my website that discloses anything that I've ever done that might make people concerned. And obviously, if I were concerned my own self, I wouldn't be running. And people who are close to me and who know me well are incredibly supportive of my run and of my candidacy. But I wanted to give voters who don't know me the same kind of insight into me that people who are very close to me have. And so I shared my my finances, my sex life, my thoughts on religion, and then a few other things besides to let people know that while I am not a flawless human being, I have a lot of experiences in common with lots of folks, and I understand the struggle that it is to be a human, and that I support everybody and understand people.
Yeah, I guess a follow up on that. It would be in this political spectrum. You mentioned there's a lot of the traditional running strategy is to, like you mentioned, present a very clean profile. And one of the big barriers that has been a problem for people of, people of a different sex or religion or some other sort of different view is that it's been a little bit of a barrier to sort of get into the white hetero male Christian political sphere. And so now that you have, you're not just transparent, but you're openly poly, openly secular to some degree. Do you think that this is also is going to help other politicians or potential politicians in the future? And do you hope to see this kind of create some momentum, if you will?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I guess the short answer is I didn't have the foresight to think my candidacy is going to break barriers. I'm going to be the first, and after me, there are going to be many more. I didn't think of my campaign in those terms. I just knew that I wanted to do it. But I have had dozens of people who have reached out to me from across the nation and say, I've always felt like I've had something to give politically, but I wasn't sure how I would handle this. And now that you've done it, I've seen that it's the right way, and I'm excited to throw my own hat into the ring. So it certainly has had that effect. And while I wouldn't have anticipated it, I'm incredibly honored and flattered that people who have good political ideas are being inspired by my campaign to throw their hats into the ring, as opposed to feeling like our society is one where good political ideas only count if you are, everything that you just said, white, hetero, male, Christian, etc.
Right, right.
So you've mentioned, you've got the scandals and controversy page, and you're definitely getting some attention from that for people who could see themselves doing the same thing in the future. Definitely got our attention You know, given that you listed your religious stuff under scandals and controversy, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your potential constituency on your scandals and controversy section of your website?
It's been heartening because as we would all expect logically, that, you know, these things shouldn't have anything to do with running for office. You know, and for no other job do we worry about people's sexual predilections, right? Whether you're hiring a subordinate, if you're a manager in a company, you don't ask the people that you're interviewing about their sex life, and you don't care about it. Right. And similarly, when you're interviewing a company, you don't say, you know, what kind of sex is the CEO around here having, because it matters. And the same with religion, right? We don't ask, you know, what's the religion of the managers here, or what is your religion if you're trying to get hired here? Because we recognize that those things are not, they have no bearing on one's ability to do a particular job. And the same is, in fact, politics, and fortunately, most people recognize that. And so I have had overwhelmingly positive feedback about my strategy, including from people who, you know, are nominally conservative, who in their own lives may be, you know, a church-going Christian or something else, or be in a monogamous marriage or whatever else. They are grateful to me for just being honest with them about who I am, and they are excited that politically they can expect that honesty from me as well.
From, you know, like I said, from living in Arizona, I can see how honesty has always played pretty large in political discourse in Arizona. I mean, whether or not it's actual honesty or just sort of that manufactured honesty you get from politicians. So I can see that playing really well. What I don't see playing quite as well is including religions on a religious discussion on a scandals and controversy section, because Arizona does tend to be a fairly religious state. What was your thinking behind putting the religious section on your scandals and controversy page?
Well, again, so be clear, there is nothing on that page that I think is actually scandalous or controversial. I put it under that heading because I, you know, just in case other people feel that way. So having said that, I am not anti-religious itself. First of all, I think what is important, and certainly what is embodied in our Constitution and extends certainly here to Arizona, is that there should not be a religion that gets particular preference or attention, right?
Right.
And I know that my own family, that many, regardless of, you know, what the reality is out there, there are many Christians who feel like their freedom of speech is, you know, being abridged or attacked, that people are trying to silence them. And so, you know, what I think people are excited about in my campaign is that I am friendly to religion. I'm not hostile to religion. And I want religious people to be able to express themselves politically. And they can rely that I will not give preference to a particular religion. So if a Muslim person can be just as excited about me as a Christian person, as a Hindu person, et cetera, as an agnostic, or atheist, or otherwise secular type of religion. So, I have not, because I have so many relationships with family and friends, who are, you know, religious and spiritual, and I've been able to maintain those, you know, all of those folks do trust that, you know, my campaign is not about in any way silencing religion or the rise of of agnosticism to the detriment of religion. It's just how things are in my head, and I wanted to be honest about that, and I wanted to make sure that as a candidate, I didn't have to feign, you know, what was going on in my own head.
So what would you say to the electorate out there who see the idea of a secular government that is not secular as in a non-religious government, but a secular government as a non-sectarian government a government that does not make a decision. What would you say to the electorate who believes that a secular government is an abridgment of their religious freedoms?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing that Abraham Lincoln said about slaves, right? Like, if slavery is about color, then somebody whiter than you can enslave you. And if slavery is, about intellect, then somebody smarter than you can enslave you. So if religion is about Christianity, then you've got to be careful, right? Because that means that, at some point, maybe a non-denominational Christian church gets, pushed aside, or a Mormon church gets pushed aside, or a Baptist church gets pushed aside. And so there are always smaller and smaller divisions. And if I belong to any religion, I would certainly be afraid that, and in fact, Christians are, right? Like, I hear people tell me that they're concerned about Sharia law being put in place, right? So in the same way that you wouldn't, if you're against Sharia law, you wouldn't want to see that put here, you must be coherent and extend to others that they may not want to be forced to live exactly the way you are. And there's no threat there. Government doesn't stop people from living as Christians, and it doesn't stop Muslims living as Muslims or anything else. And that's the way it should be. That is specifically in our Constitution, and I support that absolutely. And I am excited to work for people who do find value in religion, that it gives them strength, that it makes them volunteer, that it gives them purpose and meaning and whatever else. That's freaking beautiful, and I'm incredibly supportive of that. And there's nothing about my candidacy or about a secular government that seeks to stop that.
So moving on to a different point of policy, a few years ago, not related to your gubernatorial campaign, you attempted a project where you're going to live without privacy for a whole year, for 24/7 for that entire year. Can you tell me about that project?
Yeah, that was on the heels of Snowden and continued leaks and revelations about what our government was doing. And the bottom line is, I was and am concerned about an imbalance in privacy between government and citizens. And if anything, I feel like government should be more transparent than citizens. And so as we recognize that there's value in transparency, and so my experiment there was to see what it would mean for an individual to live incredibly transparency and what kind of, disadvantages and advantages that would bring. And I recognize at the time and still say that when any particular group of individuals has less privacy than another group, that information imbalance is dangerous. And now so my campaign was about raising awareness for the dangers of imbalance, and the imbalance right now, and still is 2 years later, is our government has a shadow arm that does things that most Americans aren't comfortable with. And as a candidate for governor, I want to stand up for the privacy and equality of information such that, government bureaucrats and people in spy and law enforcement agencies don't have a cloak of privacy, of a lack of transparency, while they, on the other hand, spy incredibly deeply into Americans' lives en masse and on a personal level without any kind of accountability.
That's actually a little bit relieving, because I when we were doing the research for this interview, I saw this I saw this campaign that you had previously and your transparency in your gubernatorial campaign, and I was concerned that as a person who is a technologist and believes in personal privacy, that there was two ways this position of yours could go. One was the position that you have taken, which is, we need a more transparent government and personal privacy is important. But I was a little concerned that maybe your point was personal privacy wasn't that important. So I'm actually quite gratified to find out we're on the same page on that one.
Yeah, as I focus on my campaign, there has been by the media a significant misreporting around that as though, you know, people haven't processed what that meant then, and certainly they've extended it into now. And so, you know, that's not something I'm at all pursuing now, A, but B, I think they've miscategorized even what I was trying to do and draw attention to in the past. And so with, you know, the media having a much bigger megaphone than I have, getting people to understand that is going to be, I think, one of the major things. Because if I get dismissed as this freaky guy who doesn't care about privacy and his campaign is about taking away privacy of Arizonans, that would be false. And if I can't correct it, then that would be unfortunate.
Well,
and it would endanger my campaign for sure.
Happy to give you that opportunity. But moving from digital...
I appreciate that.
Moving from digital privacy to finance, you've called a state debt an unfair tax on future generations, and you've said that that if there is a debt, that you would favor a budget that rapidly cuts down your that debt. Would you call that accurate?
Yes. You know, state debt and personal debt are very different things. Not that I think personal debt is some kind of amazing thing, but as a rule, you know, state debt is people today taking benefits and asking other people to pay for them. Whereas personal debt is an individual saying, I will take care of this debt later. And so there's an incredibly different moral context there. And, you know, short of, you know, something like World War II or anything like that, you know, today's generation asking tomorrow's generation to pay for government services is cruel and wrong. And Arizona does have a very large debt that, you know, even if we pay substantially more towards it, will take, you know, a long time to pay back. So I'm passionate about doing that. And I think it's very important because I don't think my kids and grandkids ought to pay for the government services that people today are enjoying.
Where would you say what you are now the governor of Arizona and you're presented with a budget and you need to cut down on you need to cut the deficit? Where would you look to cut? Would you cut education? Would you cut transportation spending?
No.
Where would you cut?
So I think one of our biggest opportunities for cuts is in the correction system. We have too many people in jail for poor reasons. A lot of those reasons, if not today, at least historically, we're racially motivated, both consciously and unconsciously. For example, marijuana is a non-crime that has a lot of people in jail and disproportionately affects particular ethnicities. And keeping people in jail is incredibly expensive. It's making certain corporate executives incredibly wealthy, and it's really slogging down our economic engine, and it's quite frankly wrong. And we spend over $1 billion on it every year here, and we can straighten that out. And you know, all that. So we've got all these people in jail and corrections officers. You know, it's not a career people are very excited about because there's some sense of that going on, and they're not treated well. They're not treated well by the government, by their employer, and certainly they're not treated well by the people who are part of that system. So there's a lot of I think money that can come out of that program and you know get people's lives back on track, and that money can be used more wisely.
I think to contextualize the correction system in Arizona, Maricopa County is the most populous you know county in Arizona, and for 20 plus years the person running corrections was Joe Arpaio, known as Sheriff Joe, and his
right
and his Tent City program. And when I lived in Arizona, I lived with and worked with people who in corrections who worked at Tent City, and they did not speak fondly about it. And they did not speak fondly about Sheriff Joe. Corrections is a huge concern within Arizona and was widely discussed. And Sheriff Joe was no stranger to scandal, especially recently. Is he now officially no longer the sheriff?
He is officially no longer the sheriff. He lost at the end of 2016 there. So we're all incredibly excited about that. And, you know, he had a long stint there. But
yes, he did.
Arizona, people in Arizona got active. A lot of people who historically didn't turn out did. Mm-hmm. And, they retired, like you mentioned, the lawsuits and the scandals and everything else.
Yeah. There's also his his attention to immigration and how, I think it's safe to call his immigration policies racist because that's what the federal government did in their trial.
Yeah.
But sticking with corrections, you've advocated for, so you're talking about making cuts in the correction system, and you've advocated for psychologically proven rehabilitation programs. To what extent can we use science and data to inform and shape our corrections and prison programs?
I think using science and data for everything that government has to do is an imperative. It's just vital. Understanding what's actually going on the ground, and this is my criticism of, both our state and our national government right now, is that the problems that people are solving are non-problems. There's not data to support that the problem they're trying to solve is important, and B, to support that the solutions that are being tossed about are effective solutions to the non-problems. So, for example, a wall, Trump says, we've got murders and rapists coming from Mexico, and we need to build a wall to stop them. Well, first off, we don't. Like, that's not what the vast majority of Mexican immigrants is. And second of all, a wall, you can go over it, you can go under it, you can go around it, you can probably go through it. So, like, it is a non-solution to the non-problem. And you don't have to look at a lot of data in order to see that. And so... with that issue, and also anything else about corrections, like just putting people in jail and, giving them a label that makes it impossible for them to get an apartment, impossible for them to get a job, and all these sorts of things. Like, does this make our society better? And there's not data to support it. So when you look at data, it helps you. I think sometimes, by the way, data-driven decision-making can go wrong. And if I'm talking about Arizona, Common Core, Arizonans are very concerned about the educational system here. We don't invest enough in it. We have great teachers who don't get paid very much. And because of things that go on, and, we have a system that, really supports charter schools and private schools and really neglects public schools. It's like new age segregation and things like that. And because of all those things, Arizonans aren't very proud of our education. Well, one thing we did for a while that was positive was a new teaching method, the latest data-driven teaching method, which is called Common Core, that encourages kids to think differently about how they're learning. And there was all sorts of data to support that this is the right way to teach the next generation of kids. So it was a data-driven decision that got implemented, but it was rolled out poorly. It was just kind of like, here's how we're teaching kids now. And parents couldn't do their kids' homework anymore. Like, the kids were bringing home homework, and parents couldn't do it because it wasn't how they'd been taught. And parents rebelled. They're like, I didn't learn this way. Why should anybody else learn this way? And so there's a messaging problem. And, our current superintendent of public instruction won because she went out and said, I want to tear down this data-driven this data-driven way of teaching, right. and was successful on that. So, being data-driven still requires proper messaging and proper education of the populace. And you can't just do the right thing and expect that, and by the right thing, I mean the most effective solution that the data points to, and expect that everyone will automatically hop on board. You still have to teach people. You still have to get input. You still have to get buy-in. And I think had the state as an entity said, look, we're going to do something rather radical, and you're not going to be able to automatically do your kids' homework anymore. It's not the same as 2 + 2 = 4. It's more thoughtful. It's more engaging. It's different ways of thinking about things. But if you support this, your kids will be smarter, and your kids will rise in standing in the nation in terms of education. So I think people would have gotten behind it, and I still think that they can. So I haven't given up hope that
I could do an entire show on Common Core. I'm actually an advocate for it, but I think it's more a failure in marketing
because you're a data guy,
right? Also, it's the way, specifically in mathematics. I'm a technologist, as are you. It is the way I do math. So I'm gonna let this interview go a little bit longer because there's a couple of questions that I want to ask. If you need to go, just let us know. But Josh, you have
actually he already answered my question. I was asking how would you address? Just Josh. How would you address?
Yeah.
This issue, the messaging a portion of it, what do you see as a good means for actually messaging to people that might not be so welcoming to this messaging?
I think that as a marketer / advertiser, I have some experience in that, and the government does recognize its role as a message giver. We have PSAs already that say things like, don't let your kid do marijuana. we have sometimes messaging that the government is sending that's ineffective, but we also have important things like, don't go swimming in the canal and don't leave your children in hot cars and whatever else.
Yeah.
So, don't drive through floods.
Right.
So when you, if the government uses its existing channels, I think the government does have a big, megaphone, so to speak, that getting that message out would not be incredibly difficult. And the more the government gets out, useful and good messages, data-driven messages, I think the more the public will be interested in going to the government to get good information. Whereas now, there's a lot of I think concern that people would have that the information that they're getting is partisan or
fake-ish.
Otherwise tainted and not good.
Alternative.
Yeah. Well, moving.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want government alternative facts from your government, ideally.
Well, moving on to probably the best political interview question I've ever asked. You list stage hypnotist as one of your hobbies. How would you convey to voters that you won't use those skills on them?
Well, yes, I absolutely will use those skills on them. No, my victory was assured the moment I declared. stage hypnotism is—it's not a thing where you can't hypnotize people who are resistant to it, and you can't get them to do things that they are unwilling to do. So movie plot lines to the contrary, you can't get someone to murder somebody if they otherwise wouldn't, and you can't get them to vote for somebody if they think it's abhorrent. So while you can get them to do things that they are uncomfortable, like clucking like a chicken is not something you would probably do typically, it's also not something that you find morally repugnant. Similarly, people can, there's no power in hypnotism to, look through a TV screen or be at a rally and magically get people to change their vote. So I have to do that the same way every other politician does.
Fantastic. So moving on from hypnotism, because I just wanted to say, moving on from hypnotism, you advocate for teaching computer programming at very early grade levels. How would that work out? I mean, I am a technologist. I worked in I did RF engineering, data integration, and I did real estate software for a million years. Nathan here is
I'm an IT for Microsoft.
Yeah,
There's all sorts of technology bits that were definitely. I have kids, so that's, I'm right there in that. What are we doing with this technology and kids problem?
How would you see bringing in technology into the K-12 system?
What I would love to see is in every teacher's room, there's a Python interpreter up on day one.
Not Python. Sorry.
Next will be
Python. It doesn't have to be Python. whatever it is, and the first activity you do as a class is you learn everybody's name. You put it into a list or a dictionary or whatever else, and you write the algorithm that's going to randomly call on people. So instead of drawing sticks from a cup or whatever else, you show how you can take number. And again, I understand that the notion of randomness and modulus and stuff like that is going to be, over students' head a little bit. But you show them immediately how a little bit of code can get something done. And I think over time, again, literally in kindergarten, people are using the alphabet, but they're learning the alphabet, so they're not going to be incredible coders. But what they can learn is the logic, right? If and and statements and loops and so on. I think children are capable of understanding those concepts before they're able to write them down or recognize the letters that compose them. And as you move through school, I would love to see every student has their own GitHub where they have the calling on a random person in class library and other pieces of code that they've written themselves. And by the time they're in fifth grade, sixth grade, ninth grade, seniors in high school, they have made for themselves, libraries that can be used to get things done, and that they understand, therefore, what open source library is, and they understand the value of not redoing work all the time. They understand the value of collaboration, all sorts of things. So that's a simple example of how I would love to see things move.
So you're an open source guy, then?
Well, I mean, it certainly saved me hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. So.
Oh, no.
I'm not.
I definitely am. I mean, I'm using an Arch Linux rig to record this right now. So, very much an open source guy. So, I see that you list Eagle Scout among your accomplishments. How do you feel about the Boy Scouts of America requiring its members to profess a faith in God and excluding atheists and agnostics from their ranks?
Certainly I don't support that by any means. The good news is, while I am not up to the date minute by minute on where the Boy Scouts are at, I do know that they just changed rules, regarding, gays and transgender and things like that, issue was just getting so big for them that they reverse positions in a more inclusive way.
Yeah.
And I imagine that religion is shortly behind that. So, and again, I don't know if there's a, there was a lot of people making a lot of noise about the LGBTQ stuff in Scouts. I don't know that there's a large contingent of atheists and agnostics who are saying, I want my kid to be a Scout and I don't want them to have to take this oath, so that may be why it's coming slower. But to the degree that, certainly I think it's a wrong position, and I think it's one that, a very little bit of activism would solve in short order.
All right, so if people want to keep up with you and your campaign, where would I send them?
NoahDyer.com, Facebook.com/AZGov, Twitter.com, at AZGov2018, same on Instagram, EasyGov2018. So social media, website, I typically blog on the order of once a week, sometimes twice a week, sometimes once every other week. So lots of things going on, and social media is updated typically a couple times a day with different things that are going on and people that I meet and conversations that I have. So no shortage of ways to stay in touch.
Fantastic. Noah Dyer is running for governor of Arizona. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
This is Ask an Atheist. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
You can go to our website, askanatheist.tv, email me at questions@askanatheist.tv, or Twitter as askanatheistwa. Our voicemail is 844-753-7842. That's about it. Thanks, everybody who works on the theme music, and see you guys next week.